Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When I woke up this morning, I went to open my blinds and the cord snapped in my hand. So when I went to fix that, the blinds came out of the wall and showered the floor with plaster. And when I went to hoover up the plaster, my hoover exploded. And I then just sat there for about 25 minutes. Anyway, I'm in a terrible mood. Can we record the podcast,
really,
please?
Is.
Intro music goes here. Nick, again, we apologise for what we're about to put you through.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, I'm John Elledge, and this is Skylines, the City Metric podcast. I'm here again with my colleagues, Nikki Wolf and Sarah Menavis. About 3 minutes ago, I said to one of them, do you know how to, like, put the mics up? And they said, oh, no, I've never learned to do that, because then people ask you to do stuff. So rather than publicly shaming them, I'm going to leave it hanging so that you think it's both of them, because it would literally, I mean, like, the other one would definitely have said the same thing if push had come to shove. So I'm in a great mood.
Teachable moment, don't learn things.
That is true. That's what women get tricked into doing everything in life, because they are forced to learn.
Did that happen to me? How come I'm the guy who has to do everything?
Maybe you should ask for some help.
Anyway, as we record this, it's Friday, February 1st. It's snowed a bit in London, but not a huge amount. But, you know, in other parts of the world, such as, I know, the US Midwest, it's basically under about... It's like minus 30 or something out there, isn't it? It's incredible. So we're gonna talk about extreme weather. Sarah... What's going on in the Midwest?
I think we've all, hang on, immediately just run into the fact that we speak either Celsius or Fahrenheit. I don't think either of us speaks both.
So I speak both.
So it's 50, it's minus 52
It's Fahrenheit. So the Celsius is actually minus, it's been recorded to be minus 46 overnight. It was the coldest in Chicago.
Isn't that somewhere around the point at which Fahrenheit and Celsius are the same?
That's it minus does, yeah. 32.
Do they dovetail out the other way after that? Or?
I don't,
because 1 degree Fahrenheit is smaller than 1 degree Celsius. So hang on, do you speak Fahrenheit?
I love that you guys don't know how
what the
math
hell? You
works.
So, all right, so this isn't specifically what this podcast was
no,
about.
But this is exactly the kind of shit that the listeners will like. So yeah, let's do this.
Here's my running thesis on why Fahrenheit is better than centigrade.
I'm with you on this already.
So there's three different temperature ranges.
Don't talk about Kelvin.
Kelvin's useful for science, right? Like, it's not really useful for anything other than science.
We need to talk about Kelvin.
There we go. That was good, John.
It's the name of a book. I didn't invent that.
But centigrade, which is based around the boiling temperature of water, is useful for cooking. Like, it's useful for when you want to know, like, what something should be in the oven for how long so that it boils or, like, whatever. It's not very useful for working out whether or not you're going to need a jacket today, because the range of, like, human temperature goes from about 0 to, like, 32, and that's not very granular in terms of working out whether you need a jumper or a slightly warmer jumper. Whereas Fahrenheit, 0 to, like, 30 is f***ing cold. 30 to, like, 40 is damn cold. 40 to 50 is, like, a bit chilly. 50 to 60 is, like, mild-ish.
Like, springy weather.
Yeah, and then 60 to 70 is, like, warmish. 70 to 80 is, like, pretty hot. And then 80 plus is, like, really hot.
Well, and also it's just there's more numbers. Like, when you... Yeah. Like, there's more degrees involved in Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Like, for every 1 degree Celsius, it's, like, 2 degrees Fahrenheit. I think not quite 2 degrees, but almost. I'm doing a very expressive hand gesture at the moment. I'm getting very into it, but I do feel very irritated about this because I think it is much more specific. And so the fact that it can be 13 degrees or it could be 17 degrees, and that's, like, a wildly different set of temperatures, that really pisses me off.
But, okay, like, so two things about this. Firstly, I think I'm right in saying that, like, we all know that, like, centigrade Celsius is, like, you know, freezing point of water to boiling point of water is 0 and 100. I think 0 and 100 in Fahrenheit is the freezing and boiling points of salted water or something weird like that. And that's weird and unintuitive. No, there's definitely something like that.
I've been in New York when it's been 100 Fahrenheit, and I don't think any water would boil if you put salt in it. 100 Fahrenheit is about 30. Five.
There is some logic to it originally. Maybe I've got that wrong. There's some logic to it where it's like, but this is deeply unintuitive. Like, set of chemicals.
It doesn't matter what it originally is. The way to remember it is that, like, in terms of when you're going out that day, zero is
This brings me to my other point. It's like, I do not understand Fahrenheit. To understand what a temperature in Fahrenheit means, I have to translate it into Celsius. It's not a decision I've made. I can't understand kilometres either. I have to translate them into miles.
But there's nothing about the number 35 degrees that implies to me that's going to be hot. But in Celsius, that is hot because it's just over a third of the way to the boiling point of water.
How did you get like this? You grew up in this country where it's all Celsius.
Well, I've been living in America 6 years, remember? And also, it's just so easy to, like, once everyone's talking in it, you just go into Fahrenheit.
Yeah, I think it is that. It's like all of the temperatures are like almost personified when you talk in Fahrenheit in the US. Like, you don't talk about, like, you talk about the 60s or the 50s. Like, you talk about a fucking decade, but it's like the temperature. And you're like, oh, what's it like outside? Oh, it's in the 60s. And you know, hey, you're not going to need a jacket. But if it's like, it's the 40s, you should put on some socks.
I don't know.
If it's in the 20s. Oh, shit. Like, it's going to be cold
outside. Whereas
if
someone in England is like,
I don't know what that means. I would have to translate it into
Celsius.
It's so easy. It's a 0 to 100 scale where 100 is hot and 0 is cold.
Yeah, but like, you keep saying hot and cold as if these are in some way scientific measurements.
It's not about scientific measurements. We're not trying to, like,
it's about how sweaty or
chilly you're going to be.
Yeah.
How big a jacket do you need?
Or how hard your nips are going to be. Yeah. But I don't know if that's a city metric appropriate.
The fact we've been recording this podcast for 10 minutes, we've had like 3 different personal stories and a lengthy digression on how temperature scales work without getting to the actual topic we originally came here to discuss. It's the most city metric thing that's ever happened in the whole history of the universe. So that's fine.
So I would like to say something about the London weather. And this is something I felt for both London and Edinburgh, where I also lived in the UK. And I understand it. And people on Twitter are like, oh, then it's different in Canada and America. You get real snow. But the thing is like the fact that there can be like a light dusting of snow and there's like a bit of sludge on the ground and like no one has salt to f-ing stop it. And the whole thing, it's like, oh, shit, what are we going to do? Like, people are literally going to die over something that's like super normal and
but
really
it's not
that
super normal. That's why we don't invest
over something that's not actually as like dramatic, I guess. And that's the thing.
Yeah,
yes,
it's not dramatic, but the reason we don't have the equipment is because we don't get enough snow to justify the investment. We don't have snow plows for the same reason.
But yeah,
it snows
I'm
for
not
like
saying
maybe
snow
a week
plows.
A year.
I'm saying like
year.
Bag of salt.
Also, to be fair, I haven't seen anyone like panicking for this particular snowfall. I haven't seen
you haven't been watching BBC
closed.
Breakfast.
Oh,
the airports have closed. In Chippenham, it looks like
Chippenham
fucking hell on earth.
But they
it
always
looks like
do
Siberia
this.
And
like,
Chippenham.
There was a big snowstorm.
I'm in
about
touch.
10 years
I watch
ago.
BBC Breakfast every morning.
Where is Chippenham?
Southwest. Yeah, it's in Wiltshire.
There was a big
it's
snowstorm
on the
about. Can I maybe get to the end of this sentence? There was a big snowstorm about 10 years ago. Like all the news. Cars kept trying to sort of make out that like people were panicking and like on the verge of like, you know, and just everyone was having a really good time and this went on for a month. Like Charlie Brooker took the piss out of this extent. Now I've got to the end of this sentence. It wasn't a great sentence, I'm going to be honest.
I mean, once school's closed...
Did they tell you what happened to my blinds this morning? It's been a long day.
Once it snows enough for schools to close, you're either on the one hand... Like, schools and work to be off. Like, you're either on the one hand, like, having a f***ing great time because you're off work or school, or you're a parent.
You're a journalist. It's snowing is never going to be enough to get you off work again.
No, but I can work from home.
Exactly. So, like, you'll still be... But that's still working.
Yeah Nikki, isn't it? Says Nikki, whose job is remote
To be honest, like coming into the office means that I'm like sat at a desk with people watching me scroll through TweetDeck for most of the day with like some brief bursts of intensive activity. But that's
everyone's job, not even just in journalism. I think that's everyone's job.
And it's this wider point of like the problem with offices in general, which is that like you come in and have to like perform work more than you have to actually do your job, whereas you can like you can work much more efficiently if no one's working.
Well, I was talking with our colleague Indra about this just this afternoon because I think that my boyfriend works really solidly from like 9:30 to like 3 without a single break. And then he's pretty much done for the day. And I feel like I could do all of my work, like, you know, with those extra hours where I'm just like, you know, let's check Twitter and see what like everybody's up to there. I think if I just binged and literally did nothing but like literally stare at a Word document for like 7 hours a day.
Can we get back to the topic we came here to discuss?
Yes. Oh, no, but what I was going to say, which is very sad.
Oh, God, it's not going to be about the topic, is it?
It is about the topic. I was going to say is it was very pitiful for me. It was the first time I ever was like, I think I had the mind of a parent because I'm a dog parent. And I was watching my poor little dog trying to take a shit this morning while she was sliding around on all the sludge and the ice and the snow. And it was very sad. And I thought, someone needs to salt these roads. So my dog can stand still and get all of her shit out of her ass.
That also wasn't a sentence it was worth getting to the end of, if we're honest with ourselves, was it?
Please Please mind the gap between the train and the platform.
So, breaking into that conversation, I am back once again at the Centre for Cities for our Ask the Experts section with Head of Policy Paul Swinney. Paul, you are drinking out of a Sunderland-themed mug, I've just noticed.
Well, yes, I am, and it makes the tea taste even better, and it's nice to be able to, you know, remind yourself of home whenever you take each slurp.
Yeah, you know, I was very confused by the fact there's Farringdon and Hendon on there, but there's also Washington, there's Seaburn, there's Hilton. So, you know, it's, really, I just recognise some of those places from the Tyne and Metro map is all I'm saying here. So, anyway, we are going to talk about, well, we're going to talk about austerity. You guys have just had your big annual report out, Cities Outlook 2019. And this year you look largely at the question of cities' finances. What did you find? Did you find that they're all, that it's boom time, everyone, all local government bodies are doing pretty well for themselves and everyone's in a great state?
Yeah, I mean, I think local government is awash with cash and everybody's is well aware of that. You know, what's interesting about, I think, the process over the last 2 or 3 years is once upon a time, austerity was the most politically contentious policy of the 21st century, and yet that's just been completely swamped by discussions of Brexit over the last couple of years. So we thought it was important to look at this topic, not only because of that, but also because we've got the spending review coming up this year as well, where the Chancellor will set out how much money different departments will get. Now, what's really interesting within this is, you know, 8 or 9 years of austerity so far, is that local government has been the hardest hit of any public sector department. You know, it's cuts of around about 50 to 60% in terms of amount of money that they get from central government. That's in the context of, say, the NHS seeing a real terms increase, international aid seeing a real terms increase. You know, in order to protect some of these areas, local government has really gotten in the neck and has shouldered far more than I think you would expect to be acceptable in terms of sort of, you know, austerity. And so when George Osborne said, you know, we're all in it together, he definitely wasn't talking about local government, and he definitely wasn't talking about certain parts of local government as well, which I'm sure we can come on to.
So the figures you just named there were like 50, 60%. Those are the figures that people tend to talk about when they say, oh, local government has seen cuts of X. Those are the kind of numbers you hear. One of the things that struck me about your City's Outlook report was that the cuts you found have not been quite that deep. Like, the biggest cut was Barnsley, I think, which was 40%. Don't get me wrong, it says terrible things. We've reached a point where you see a cut of 40% and you think, oh, that's actually not that bad. But nonetheless, that is less bad than I expected it to be. What explains the disparity?
You've been desensitised, I think, over the last 8 or 9 years.
So, Stockholm syndrome.
Quite. So in terms of the figures of cuts that central government have put in place, that's cuts to grant. So that's cuts that to the amount of money that central government passes on to local government. Now, of course, you know, there are other sources of income for local government. So there's council tax, there's a little bit more of business rates now because they've changed the system slightly. There's also money raised from sales fees and charges, so charging for access. And there's also money raised in this, so this weird other thing that local government sort of writes down. It's called other income. And that's income from non-central government departments, like the NHS, for example, or the National Lottery, or probably a whole host of other things that get thrown in there as well. Now, the reason why we were interested in looking at that sort of whole gamut of spending funded by these different income streams is because we wanted to look at how services have changed for people who live in different parts of the country. So, you know, we could talk about, have a technical discussion about what, how sustainable is local government, you know, which councils might fall over. But actually, I think there's a bigger element here that, you know, austerity ultimately is applied to people. And we want to say, well, how has that played out across the country and how has that affected people on a day-to-day basis in terms of, you know, spending on your museums, parks, libraries, social care, how clean are your streets, and investigate that element of it.
Sure. So let's kind of drill down into it then. If you're kind of looking at these councils that have seen cuts of, you know, 20, 30, 40%, how have services changed? What's different from 10 years ago?
It's very interesting, I think, to see the makeup of how councils spend their money. So in terms of the cuts, what we've seen is that there's certainly evidence that I think councils have cut back office functions and tried to keep frontline services going, which is very, very commendable. But then when you look in within the individual service lines, what you see is that social care has very much been protected. That's not a surprise. Local government has to deliver that by law, and we've seen growing demand for it as well.
Social care is largely care of the elderly, right?
Well, it's more than that. You know, it's children's social care. Obviously, some of that's been in the news in recent years. But also, a lot of even adult social care is much more than just the elderly population. We think that straight away, but it's mental health, it's people with learning difficulties, etc. You know, demand for those services has been on the rise in recent years. So what you've seen is that big cuts to local government and cities, especially within that, which we can come on to. So they've had to deal with these cuts to money coming from central government, but also having an increase in demand for social care. So then what you're doing is your more limited money is actually then being funneled even more into a certain service line to deliver these services for very vulnerable people. Now, the upshot of that means that all the other stuff that local authorities provide, because they are custodians of place, not just providers of social care, that's the stuff that's had to be cut back, because ultimately you're not going to be taken to court for not providing cultural events or not keeping the streets as clean as before, cutting the grass in the way that you did in the past. And so it's those other areas that have really been squeezed. That's stuff that, you know, local authorities don't have to provide, but actually is pretty important in terms of, you know, the fabric of a place.
Placemaking and so on.
Yes, just
the idea
precisely.
Civic identity is kind of so bound up in, you know, keeping places nice and providing cultural events and so on. Let's talk about the geography of the cuts, because they've not been felt evenly, have they? Some places have seen deeper cuts than others.
Indeed. I think what's interesting is the story that I think we've heard over recent years is one of county councils really struggling. You know, Northamptonshire's been all over the news. Somerset has been in trouble as well.
And is that because they're the ones, the upper tier authorities, are the ones lumbered with social care, basically?
So yes, they are responsible for social care. But at the same time, actually, we have had some extra grant going into social care in recent years. Now, this isn't to say that, you know, county councils or more rural authorities haven't had it hard. I mean, again, we've got to stress that all of local government has been really hard hit, and the hardest hit department of any public sector department. But when it comes to actually looking at the figures, it's been urban authorities that have actually been hardest hit. You know, the size of the cut in cities has been twice as large as what it has been in elsewhere in Britain. But then even then within that, there's a geography, which is it's cities in the north of England that are particularly being hit hard. So if you think about austerity, local government is being hit the hardest of any public sector body. Within that, cities have been hardest hit. And then within that, it's been cities in the north of England in particular that have shouldered the burden of austerity and been hit the hardest. As you said, Barnsley, hardest hit in terms of absolute cuts. Liverpool, hardest hit in terms of cuts on a per capita basis. Places like Doncaster and Wakefield up there as well. And the geography very much is the north of England in terms of the burden. So I think we obviously had to do something about public sector finances in 2010. Cities in the north of England have more than done their fair share, really put their shoulders to the whatever the phrase is, you know. And
I'm enjoying this metaphor.
and really sort of, you know, played their part, to throw in another cliche. But I think enough's enough now. I think when it comes to the spending review, we have to reflect this, that, you know, local government has been hammered, but, you know, cities in the north of England in particular have really been hit hard, really played their part to help sort of improve public sector finances. And that needs to be recognised.
Just one final question on this. Like, something you, like, you hear a list of names like Doncaster, Barnsley, Liverpool, Wakefield. What they all have in common, apart from being slightly down the hill cities in the north of England, is they tend to vote Labour. And, like, looking at the map, it's not across the board, but fairly, like, there does appear to be a correlation between places that tend to vote Labour have taken fairly deep cuts. Like, even in the south of England, London has taken deeper cuts than many of the smaller cities around it. London votes, tends to vote Labour, the smaller cities around it tend to vote Tory. Like, how cynical should we be about this? Like, is it, like, I assume it's not simply a matter of, like, the government looked at a place's voting record, but, like, is there, like, some correlation with, like, the kind of places that tend to vote Labour also have the kind of populations that have seen the biggest cuts? Like, how does this work?
Yeah, so it's definitely those places that have got high levels of deprivation in particular that have been hit harder by the cuts. Yes, they tend to vote Labour. I, however, think that it was more government ineptitude rather than any particular sort of malice as to why we see the geography that we see. So the way the cuts were applied was in 2010, government said, you know, we've got to apply a cut. And let's say they said, we're going to apply a cut of, let's say, 20% to local government grant, or grant that government gives to local government. And everywhere is going to take this 20% cut to their grant. And on the face of it, that seems quite fair. Everywhere's going to shoulder a 20% cut. However, the problem is, like I said earlier, you know, government grant is not the only source of income that local authorities get. So you have got things like council tax, a bit of business rates now, sales fees and charges, and this magical other income area too. So if you then look at a place like Hull, for example, 50% of its income-ish comes from central government grant. So actually it's pretty reliant on central government grant. If we instead say look at a place like Worthing, we say it's around about 25%. So if you then say so if you take a 20% cut to 50% of your budget, that's actually a much deeper cut than a 20% cut to just 25% of your budget. And if you've got a larger council tax base, you can raise more money, you can offset some of these cuts as they come through too. There was also a second element that there were also a whole host of one-off grants that local authorities got. They were tend to be skewed towards cities in the north of England because that's where the biggest problems are. A lot of these were sort of cut with the stroke of a pen in 2010. So again, you know, all these grants were scrapped. It so happened that the geography of those were that it was cities in the north of England that were more reliant on it. Interestingly, the government did change its approach in around about 2015, where they said, oh, actually, we recognise we made a bit of a mistake here, and they stopped applying this uniform cut to government grant. However, interestingly, they haven't reversed that. So while they've stemmed the blood flow, you know, it hasn't sort of improved the picture, and that's why we then continue to see this geography if we look over the whole period.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I have learned something here today. I hope the listeners have too. Thank you, Paul.
My pleasure.
Please mind the gap between the train and the platform.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So, Sarah, you've written a piece for the New Statesman about, what are they calling it, the polar vortex? What's going on in the
Midwest? They always call it the polar vortex, and I thought that was a proper noun for the 2014 thing. But yes, I think it's technically a polar vortex. I've written, I think, quite a serious piece, despite my jovial mood.
I mean, it's like 12 people like have died.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And like, so this is in Chicago, where like hell freezes over like once every 4 years. Chicago in 2014 had this like really like insane global news story style kind of, you know, snowstorm. And essentially, it makes for like really good like, oh, look at Chicago. The waves have frozen mid-crest on like Lake Michigan. And like, oh, look at their snowbanks and they're having to set fire to train tracks. But essentially, like people die. 110 people died in 2014. I think, yeah, more than 10 people have died this time around after like 3 days of it. The whole city stops. Like a huge major, like one of the biggest cities in the US literally is at a standstill and can't do anything. And it's apparently very eerie and creepy. It's like if you were walking down Oxford Street at 4 p.m. on a Saturday and no one was there.
So what happens? So
for context of like what minus 52 degrees Fahrenheit like actually is, one of the most illustrative photos I saw come out of this was someone who'd like made a bowl of noodles, gone outside with a fork, lifted it up, and then just let go of the fork. And in the time they'd lifted it up, the noodles had frozen enough that it kept the fork there. Well, I'm demonstrating it with my hands. That just might just make it for great radio. Frostbite after 5 minutes in that kind of thing.
Actually, apparently in Chicago now, you can get frostbite in under 60 seconds.
Jesus.
I mean, that's like nuts.
I was there like, because I was in Ohio, which was like not hit as badly as Chicago. And I was actually in Chicago before this in 2013, 2014, that winter. I mean, I was in Chicago just before it happened. And then in Dayton, just as it was happening. But my dad and my sister, because I left a bit early, but they were sending me videos of them boiling a kettle, going outside, throwing the kettle water into the air, and it instantly turning to snow, like the second it went outside. It's absolutely mad. Like, it honestly, it's like insane.
This is literally incomprehensible to me. I just can't imagine this.
Yeah, it's bonkers.
Sorry?
It's like you've never heard of a kettle before. It's like a machine that you boil water in.
I enjoyed that, Nikki. I know that John's not enjoying it, but I'm enjoying it. I'm here for it. It's pretty insane in Chicago, and like the public schools have closed, or the state schools, whatever, public schools in the US. But the idea, because Chicago, not to be like incredibly grim about it, because Chicago has such bad homelessness, especially amongst like literal children, they never close the schools. Like even in, you know, multiple feet of snow, ice everywhere, like they would still keep the schools open because so many kids don't get food other than at school. So the fact that they have now closed it is a pretty big deal. I have a lot of family in Chicago, so that is why I've been there before. And it is honestly, like, it's so hard to describe how cold. Like, it's just, you walk a minute and you actually feel like you're ready for death. Like, it's so cold outside, even if you're wearing like a parka and a ski mask.
Like a non-polar vortex time, like Chicago in normal winter,
exactly.
It's just like the wind, partly because of the way the city's designed, it's very kind of grid-like, even more than New York. Like, the wind just kind of funnels down the avenues and it slices straight to the bone. Like, you're right, it doesn't matter a thing. Like, I had this huge ski jacket on and it's just like, it went through it like a hot knife through butter. It's just crazy.
Well, when I had friends like move to Chicago, whether it was for university or work or anything like that, they were like, you think you know what a coat is, and then you move to Chicago and you learn what a coat is. Like, you do not understand like the level of cold. And it's true. Like, I remember when I landed in Chicago in 2013, when I was just going to spend Christmas there with my mom's family, I got out of the car in a parking lot of a Chipotle. Call back to our other episode about fast food, which you can listen to on Acast or wherever you get your podcast. And I just, the walk from going into the Chipotle to get my burrito from the car and back, I was like, I have not experienced this before. This is unlike anything I've ever felt in my whole life. I am so cold. I actually got very violent food poisoning from that Chipotle. Sweaty evening for me.
The press team at Chipotle is going to notice this podcast.
And they're going to be like, we're telling people we have listeria. Yeah. Our chicken.
I'm not sure I've ever been below about -5 at the outsides. That I'm back in centigrade here.
Yeah, that's fine.
London doesn't get below freezing that often.
That's kind of why I like the weather in the UK.
And it doesn't get too hot either.
Well, this year was horrible. And we don't have air conditioning, and I think that matters.
We don't have air conditioning for the same reason we don't have salt and snow.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just we're not set up for anything other than this kind of like grey 12 degrees.
Just that, the sine wave doesn't have big enough peaks or troughs for it to be worth it. Which is good. I mean, that's what you want in a city.
I mean, yes and no. I kind of don't want that. I sort of want, like, when you're a kid and you have like picture books and they show, like, you know, in winter there is snow everywhere. In summer it's sunshine. And what they don't show is that all four seasons are grey and boring, and that's kind of the climate I'm living in.
What do you expect with London, John? Like, London is famous for being grey and boring.
I didn't choose to be here. Like, this is
they call
where
it
I
a
am.
Big smoke, a grid.
But as someone who grew up with very traditional seasons, I had incredibly hot, like 35 degree summers, Celsius summers, and like getting down near, you know, -5, -10 degrees Celsius winters. I do quite like just the reliability of UK weather. I can go outside during any season and I can know, like, within a certain amount of bounds, I'm not going to feel too uncomfortable, like, because I'm just always prepared for it.
Okay, let's go to the other extreme. What's the kind of hottest everyone's been?
That's a good question.
So it's difficult.
I mean, for me, I would say it was probably my early 30s.
How long were you planning that?
John heard me say the coldest. He heard himself say the coldest I've ever been is -5. And he's been sitting here watching us assholes.
Planning.
Talking about bullshit seasons, and he's been cooking on that.
I honestly didn't plan that because that would be unbelievably pathetic. But we had an incredible heat wave in London in 2003. Do you remember this, Nikki? You're younger than me. Were you around?
I remember there was like a heat wave in like 2000.
The 2003 one went on
like
for like
13.
I think there was one in 2008.
2011, maybe.
The 2003 one was literally killed like, you know, tens of thousands of people across Europe.
Tens of thousands of people.
Yeah, they're not like literally like burning up on the street. But if there is a bump in the stats of like a lot of old people dying sooner than you would expect. But it was like, it got up to like 38 degrees Celsius, which is, what's that in Fahrenheit? A lot.
106, 110
it might even be,
maybe.
Yeah.
So that is, as you put it earlier, hot.
Yeah.
We had that for a season.
I think probably the hottest temperature I've been in was probably like Mississippi in August type of thing.
Oh, God, but like, don't even say that shit.
But it's like, the thing that gets me, and a lot of people say this as well, is like, it's humidity that kills me. Like, I can deal with heat, dry heat. That's almost a cliche.
No, but it's true. Like I spend my summers going to see my well, not all of my summers, but some summers going to see my Greek family in Greece. And it would have been like around the temperatures, like the way it was in London here. And we didn't have air conditioning until this past summer was the first time I experienced air conditioning in Greece. And yet, like, I don't ever have memories of being very hot. Whereas like being in DC, which is built on a literal swamp, as our president likes to remind us, being there, even just like in the like high 20s, which is obviously still hot. I remember like being there in 2015 and trying to get like a Uber or something and actually feeling enraged. Like, if I don't get out of this heat, I'm gonna lose my shit. Like, really, like, over the top. It's like a pressure cooker. Yeah, exactly.
It's like, it feels like being in some kind of like sump where all of the humidity is just kind of accumulated.
Like, you can feel the air. Like, you can walk through it like you're walking through, I don't know, like, goop. Like, it's disgusting. And so I think, but like, honestly, I actually might say that the hottest I've ever felt is actually London this past summer.
Yeah, it's my early days. Call back.
We'll see you next time.
Is that it? Is that really it? That does not feel like a podcast to me.
You've been listening to Skylines, the podcast from City Metric, the New Statesman City site. It was presented and recorded by me, John Anidge, and produced by Nick Hilton. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on iTunes, Acast, or whatever other app you use to get your podcast. And while you're there, why not leave us a nice review to tell other people we're here? It, you know, it really helps people discover the show, and I'm a megalomaniac, so the more people I can get listening to this, the better, really. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
The communion story is that when I was little, they pour in the Greek church, you all drink from the same gold chalice and the same gold spoon, and they put hunks of bread floating in the wine. And apparently I came back from taking communion to my mom, and she was like, how did it go? And I was like, oh, it was great. I got a huge piece of chicken in my communion. And it turned out that I thought that the flavor of red wine soaked in bread was like hunks of chicken floating in the communion. So there you go. I think that's a fucking funny story. That usually gets a laugh.